If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have a fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favour to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Sarah Hilton. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
All good, thank you. Surviving the summer, but yeah, all good.
Awesome. So just do a really quick one then before we get into the heart of the conversation. Maybe just a brief insight and overview of who you are, what you do, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, no problem. So thanks for the invite, first of all. So my name's Sarah Hilton. I'm a senior lecturer of football and coaching science at Wrexham University. So I've been there, I think I'm going into my ninth academic year now. And then as well as that, I'm also a UEFA licensed coach and then a coach educator for the FAW, so for the Football Association of Wales, from up to UEFA B licence. And I've done that for many, many years. And on top of that, I'm a coach mentor as well.
Amazing. So loads of different things that you've kind of dabbled in over the years and still in. So let's talk about the journey though. Where did it all begin? I know for most of us that go into kind of coaching and coach education in particular, it's just, it becomes a bit of an organic thing, right? Many people probably don't set out their journey thinking, I want to become a coach educator. So where did that journey begin for you?
Yeah, so like most people, you know, I grew up playing football myself, played for my country, played for the national team, played for many different clubs, got a scholarship to America again, like a lot of other players in their teens. Before going, I tore my ACL, still went, so I rehabbed for a year and then still went out there. And then almost a year to the day, I tore it again. So then it sort of forced my hand in terms of my playing career, unfortunately. So I returned home, I think I was about 19, so I was still very young. So came home at 19. Before then, I never had any interest in even coaching in any capacity. I just wanted to play. And it's a bit of a strange one, my journey. So I sort of rebelled against football slightly. So I was quite, obviously, it shattered my world that I couldn't play. I couldn't watch it on the TV. I couldn't do any, you know, it was really painful, emotionally painful for me, as well as obviously physically painful. But I then sort of rebelled from football and then decided to do something completely different. And I went to work for an airline and became cabin crew for a short-haul European airline company. Moved down to London, had a ball for just under a year, but then I'm so glad I did it because it sort of was a bit of, it gave me some time away to sort of process everything, and then I felt ready. So because of obviously my previous experience with the national governing body here in Wales, and I'd gone through the player pathway myself, I knew a lot of coaches and I knew a lot of staff members who were still working for the FAW. So then I contacted someone I knew saying, I'm ready to coach now. I feel ready to get back involved in the game. So then I returned home back up to North Wales and then started to volunteer in just some fun football stuff, turn up and plays. And then I actually did, a couple of weeks after, I did my, what was then a Football Leaders Award, so you, equivalent to you, level one. And I always remember it because I did it, it was the morning that it was announced that Gary Speed had passed away. Like, it was like, that's how I always remember when it was. So it was a strange day, as you can imagine, but that was the day I did my, my level one. And then as time went on, because Coach Ed has changed a lot since then, I then did my level two, or the C license. And then I started to, once I'd done my C license, I then started to be a coach educator for the Leaders Award. You had to, and you still have to now, you have to be educate, or you have to be qualified one step above what you want to educate. And yeah, and that was, so I probably started to be a coach educator on the level one courses back when they were face-to-face over a decade ago. It must be over a decade ago now, easily. So yeah, and then things have just, as my journey as a coach has progressed, my journey sort of as a coach educator has sort of progressed as well, because with each qualification I've attained, I've then sort of become a, gone through the process of becoming an educator for the qualification underneath it. So as I say, I'm a UEFA A licensed coach now, and I educate up to the UEFA B license.
Amazing. And you know, obviously within that time, there's probably been so many changes to what coach education looks like, what is considered best practice and, or maybe not. You know, so just talk to us a little about your experiences from that perspective, obviously coming through it as a coach initially, and then obviously eventually as a coach educator. What's been the biggest change for you?
It's funny really with like the changes, because the same, it works in cycles of, you know, is, and we're very much in a cycle now with things that are coming back that we've done many, many years ago. So, you know, when you think way back to sort of your blocked practices, variable practices, you know, a lot of the names change for things, but sort of the context or the objectives of them don't really change. But I think the one thing that is a great change that's happening more so now is trying to reflect the real world more in terms of, and it's more so from maybe sort of your UEFA B license type coaches or sessions. So where you'd have sort of your half pitch practices, how we used to have functions in there as well, and all these other terms and types of practices. Yes, it's great to have a half pitch practice and have your tactical objective and stop start, you talk to that player, then you talk to that player, and you're trying to almost do a walkthrough of it, which again has its place and has its relevance. But even a B license coach, an A license coach, a pro license coach, you know, you'll have, again, time on the grass now is important, so it's less stop start than ever. And that's the biggest shift that I'm seeing now, is sort of coach education reflecting, even though it may look like what we would have called maybe over 10 years ago a variable practice or a multi-directional game or whatever you call it, you can still be an A licensed coach or a B licensed coach and run a multi-directional game, as long as it's all about the objectives and the sort of your game models and your principles, whatever term you use for those things, as long as there's a clear objective, that's what's really important. So in terms of changes, there's been so many, from going from coach centered practices to player centered practices to so many now, that I think one thing that I think is great is the freedom within practice design now as well. You know, it's not as rigid, it's not as prescriptive, especially when it comes to the educator, to the coach on the courses. You know, it's very much like, here's a structure, but you sort of map it as you want, you structure it as you see fit. So yeah, there's been loads of changes, but I do feel like there's a lot of ebbs and flows, and it's sort of, things come back in, things go, and then you'll see them again in a couple of years' time.
Well, it's interesting to say that, because I completely agree with you. And I think sometimes changing of language can complicate things for coaches, because, you know, I speak to coaches all the time, some that have maybe gone through recent qualifications, some that have gone through the past, and it's like, we're all talking about the same things, but these guys are using these set of words, and these guys are using these, so it can be quite, you know, confusing for them. But I guess one of the things that I've kind of recently started thinking about, and I don't know whether it's an intentional thing or not, or if it's even been considered in the wider context, but I guess I just think back about my childhood and growing up, and we used to just play all the time, right? we'd be out, and I'm sure it's probably similar to you, especially if you grew up playing football. You know, you'd just be playing out every day, just playing football, 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 hours and hours, and you know, you're probably doing a full time shift per week. You do 40 hours of playing football, but coaching was a specific way, and I don't know, and it's a question I've started to kind of explore. Was coaching a specific way because of the amount of free play the players had? Was that intentional? You know, has it shifted now to more, if you'd like, what's considered to be more games-based approaches and more focus on time on the ball and ball rolling time as a result of that? Is it because it is a more effective strategy in terms of developing experiences and decision-making or player capabilities? So I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, really. And there's a few different ways of looking at it, because part of me, like, you know, when you think back in the day and you talk about all those hours that you played, but also if we look at the education, the coach education that was around 20 plus years ago, and, you know, it wasn't as robust. It was more, you could say it was more free play, more standoffish, more guided discovery, if you want to use more of a pedagogical term. But I think it also is linked to the knowledge of those coaches. You know, that's what they knew. They let the game be the teacher. That's all they knew. And I think we've probably gone through moments where we've become, or we've almost overcoached players because we're making things too complicated, or that, you know, and I've been there myself, you know, where you've made something more complex than it needs to be. Because you feel like you have to, because that's what being a coach is. So there has to be sort of a tactical theme running through it. There has to be technical outcomes and technical detail that you need to get out. If you can link it to playing positions, great. Well, actually, you know, sometimes I think we've been in a habit of just over-coaching it, whereas back in the day, you know, look at the players that were produced from those generations. They're still some of the best players of all time. And you could argue, well, maybe it was because it was less coached. It was just play the game and I was on the pitch and letting football be the teacher and letting, you know, there's two goals, there's that team, and just play. So I do think sometimes we have a habit of overcomplicating something very, very simple. And I'd like to think that that's where this whole, what's happening now with Coach Ed in terms of it being really context-driven and, like, you know, there's always a hidden curriculum in football as well, in terms of, you know, managing players, managing staff and managing parents, all those sorts of things. And I think that's being addressed a bit more now, is sort of that hidden curriculum, that other things that we need to educate coaches on in terms of managing the world or that context of football. Yeah, it's an interesting thought that you've put forward, really.
It just got me thinking, because obviously within that you've got so many different ways that coaching can be successful. But, you know, I guess my question to you would be, what is good coaching for you?
Well, like you say, there's so many which ways that you could say that coaching is successful. And I think the problem is with some individuals in the game is they just see points on the board or, you know, goals, and that's the success that they need. That tells them that they're doing everything right. And we have it in coach ed courses now, you know, so if I'm mentoring some coaches and they're putting together a session plan, the one thing I say is, depending on whatever their topic might be, you know, if they're going into a small-sided game, for example, well, don't assume that because your team is scoring that you are doing a good job as a coach, you know. And I think that performance indicator is really important in the whole coach-ed environment. I think it's important that these coaches don't just see that scoring goals, or if you've got a defending topic, whatever, you know, that they haven't scored, don't assume that you are doing a good job of coaching. Or, you know, coaching's all around knowledge development. And also, and this is something that I've changed a lot with my journey now, where I'm going into sort of from a PhD perspective and also from becoming a mum myself and stuff now, it's around sort of making sure that I'm creating an environment that's allowing them to feel relaxed, to feel that they can express themselves and that they can fall in love with the game. And I think that is a massive part. You don't have to know the game to be able to do that.
So
as long as you've got two goals, you've got players, but as long as the environment you create is appropriate for them, that's something that I try and get across to all my students, to make sure that the environment is right that you're creating for those players.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's two things in there. I think the first one is around that I guess, like you said, that performance indicator of getting goals or winning games or wherever it might be. I guess, you know, it's completely understandable as to why coaches and even parents in many cases gravitate towards that, because it's probably the easiest metric to measure. And, you know, you can't really, you know, how do you measure development? Yeah, I mean, because it can go two steps forward, three steps back, four steps forward, five steps back, and it can go up and down, right? And obviously, then that's obviously, I guess, in some ways, needs to be in alignment to what the individual observing the players or the team identify as successful development, right? And I think, you know, it goes back to the challenge of sometimes when people use unopposed practices as an example. You know, the easiest thing to say, well, yeah, they're improving, but actually, is there transference from that into when they now play the live game? And I guess the other thing that kind of came up in there is that, because I've started asking this question to be a bit provocative, if I'm being honest, but because I think it is a question that should be explored. It's, well, if there's no right way to do this stuff that we call coaching, and if approaches have changed year on year, or through different cycles, how do we know anything that we're doing is actually working?
It's an interesting point, really, and a thought-provoking one. But I think if you were to ask me now around coaching, and, you know, if we look at some of the, as far as we know, those coaches that have been the most successful in terms of those, you know, those objective measures, a lot of them have had other skill sets. And I'm a big believer, you know, I've probably, in terms of the number of coach education courses that I've been on, there's probably tens of thousands of coaches that have been in front of me on a course. And just because someone, I don't know, has been involved in the game, or, you know, that doesn't equate to being a teacher or an educator or a coach, you know, having the ability to break something down and make it simple, because that's what we're all trying to do as coaches, is we're just trying to take something and break it down a bit easier so that it creates a bit of a building block to then give that back to the players. And whether that is, you know, unopposed practices, things like that, everything has a place. Everything has its sort of pros and cons. But I think as coaches, as long as you're aware of both the pros and the cons, or the positives and the negatives of that, so like unopposed practices, there's some fantastic strengths around unopposed practices, particularly obviously for older players. I wouldn't necessarily do unopposed practices. Well, technical practices, unopposed practices, I would, from a rehearsal perspective. If I'm thinking more of like advanced players around sort of shape work and stuff, that has a lot of advantages, massively, especially when we're thinking around sort of physical loading of players. But it's all everything is a block within that journey of trying to develop knowledge in the player. So as long as you understand what that block might be lacking, and where then you add a bit in to try and contextualize it more, then that's what coaching is. It's not thinking that every session you put on is the best way to do it, you know, because it's not. There's a million and one ways to do things. It's just identifying what might be best for that group of players, or what might be best for that individual, and then what additional things would you then need to do? What's the next step then in building on that base of knowledge, I guess, to sort of make it more realistic?
Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting point, because obviously within that, you've also then got to identify, right, well, where are the players at? And sometimes the challenge, you know, similar to yourself, I mentor loads of coaches, and sometimes I work with coaches, and they have what would consider assumptions about what a player can and can't achieve. And, you know, it over time, it's got me thinking, well, what is the role of a coach, really? And I've come down to this definition of, well, essentially, the role of the coach is to expose the player to more than they thought was possible for themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, that in turn requires the coach to also have someone that does that for them, because ultimately, if they're in their, you know, their current thinking, they're probably limited in terms of what they feel might be possible for the player, based on their own capability and skill sets. And sometimes, you know, the question I ask coaches: Are we putting, if you like, glass ceilings on players because of what we think they can do or what we think we can offer them?
Yeah, there's an interesting, I'm trying to think of the coach UCLA's most successful coach, John Wooden. He spoke about the law of the, well, him, and then there's another, you know, from decades and decades ago, another American coach, I think he was an NFL coach, talks about the law of the lid. And the law of the lid is you can only go if you know, basically what you're saying, if my capacity as a coach is there, I can only get plays to there. That's the lid. But I think one way we put it as well to, you know, we're talking about types of practices or learning for players, but actually, you know, you're talking about what is a coach or what's a mentor, because really it's the same, it's one and the same thing, really. But one thing, not to get too academic, but we've got something that one way of looking at it for me is that there's something called a Vygotsky zone of proximal development. Mm-hmm. It's used a lot in education and stuff as well, but basically three circles like a darts board, and you've got your, how I translate it, is sort of your comfort zone in the middle, stretch zone, and panic. And to be an effective coach, it's how you navigate that. So there'll be times where you want, just like us as mentors, we want our coaches to remain comfortable. Could be something very new, it's all context driven, but the key is to identify in the moment to stretch them and understanding what is stretched to that individual. Because what I'm, you know, I might look to stretch you, but the way in which I put you in that stretch zone maybe put another individual in a panic zone. And I think that sort of emotional intelligence and that rapport, it's a rapport thing and building a relationship. You cannot be a good mentor without having some kind of relationship and dialogue and conversation with that individual. Mm. Just like it, between coach and players, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
You've got to have that dialogue of understanding. Some are better at it than others. It can be learned, and a lot of it is an experience thing as well. You know, we get it wrong. I've got it wrong before now, and I've put coaches in a panic zone, or I've kept them in a comfort zone for too long and not stretched them enough. But that's one way that I sort of visualize it, I guess, is yeah. Sort of, you know, that's my job. Our job is, and I say it to every coach on course, is that, you know, it's our job to develop every single player in that team, regardless of their ability. Mm. So their stretch zones and panic zones and comfort zones will all be different. And that's why it's a tough job coaching.
Yeah.
But equally, it's the same for us as mentors. We've got to do, if we've got a full class of coaches, it's our responsibility to develop every single one of them in their own way, without panicking them and without pushing them too hard, but identifying the right moment to stretch each one, which is a tough job at times.
Yeah. So I mean, you make a really good point in terms of, you know, developing that rapport with players and even the coaches that you might be working with. So I guess, you know, linking it back to your own experiences, then has there been, maybe you could share certain experiences, certain times where you feel like actually on reflection, and maybe not in the moment, it might be a couple of years later that you've come across something else and it's reminded you of a past experience where you think, I probably misjudged that one, or, you know, what was it that you kind of maybe reflected on to make you feel that way in that respect?
It's an interesting one, but I think something that always pops into my mind, particularly around logistics of coach education courses, because a lot of them are time sensitive as well. And I remember quite a few years ago now, but almost, you know, you split them all into groups before their delivery day, and you've got, I don't know, maybe you've got two sessions running at the same time, one coach educator is watching one, you're watching the other, so you're literally watching the clock thinking, we can't fall behind, because, you know, it's gonna run on this day. And I remember really rushing someone really to get set up, but really thinking of that person had a right to take their time to make sure that, because in one breath I would say, make sure your session is exactly as you want it, you know, take your, it's your time, blah, blah. But then on the day, because you get into this, you know, no one wants to run past 5 o'clock, we all need to, you know, and rushing them, and but to the point where it was immediately after they delivered, really, that they said they felt it caused them to feel like rushed and less relaxed, you know, within their delivery. And that's something that I've always took, and it was quite a few years ago now, and I've always then, since that moment, thought I had no right to rush this person, because, you know, because it's unfair, if they would have been the first person delivering that day, they wouldn't have been rushed. But, you know, so things like that. And it's something, so it's not even about the actual mentoring or the coach, it's around sort of, again, that environment that I created for that individual, which then affected how they felt. They still did great, but they may not have on another day, you know, and they managed to cope, but that was all down to the environment that I'd created for that individual.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point, because, you know, it's got me thinking about certain times where I'm reflecting with certain coaches that I thought maybe, you know, obviously getting to know them and having a bit of context with them. It's going back to your previous point, really, about the stretch point. And I think it's where I recognize certain coaches have been more effective than others. I've probably have rushed them on purpose to get mm-hmm. them into that zone of, come on, let's get it going. Like, you haven't got all the time in the world, and let's see what you can come up with, sort of thing. Because that might be the stretch that they need in that moment. Whereas others, I know I've consciously said that, go on, just take your time, take as long as you need to set up. Give work within a time frame, but allow them to have that time frame and not rush them through it. But I think one of the things I'm thinking about now is, as I do that, it is constantly just managing expectations and understanding what the approach is going to be, the rationale behind the approach, so they can understand, okay, well, when I'm like this, this is the reason why. When I'm like that, this is the reason why. And like, one of the things I always do when I start a course, as an example, I literally say to them, the first thing is, I'm going to ask you a lot of questions. And it genuinely, I have to kind of reiterate to them. And again, it goes back to setting the environment. I do it with my players as well. My questions are never to catch you out. My question just to find out what you think and what you know. So then I know where I can plug myself into that journey of yours. So it's just quite interesting. But I guess linking it back to that then, you mentioned something earlier about developing rapport with your players or your coaches. So if this coach is listening to this, or even coach developers or educators listening to this now, what are some of the strategies that you go to in terms of trying to get that rapport in early? Because like you said, especially on courses, it can be quite time sensitive. Go on.
It's really important. It's so important. And I think I say that because in my experience, so we have, within the university, we run football coaching degrees, where we have the C license, B license within the degree. So I see it from both a regional course perspective, where I'm on the usual courses where we meet, you know, every couple of weeks on a Sunday or whatever. But then I also see the journey of my students when it's more day to day, more frequent and all that sort of stuff. So that time is really important. Now, again, you can't emulate being a full time student on a degree. You can't emulate that on a regional course. However, there are things. So, you know, on the course days, it is just in those moments where they're maybe asked a question, asked to speak to the rest of the guys on their table, or, you know, speak to the coach next to you, blah, blah, blah. I think it is sort of immersing yourself in that conversation. Not abruptly, you know, not being nosy and taking over the conversation. So it's almost being there, being present and listening to the conversations that are happening, because those conversations will give you an indicator of their experiences, what their thought processes are, but also their character and their personality. Because then that's a massive thing in terms of, we're talking about stretching coaches before. Well, there's, just like you would with your players, there are different ways to motivate and there are different ways to challenge players and coaches. So getting to know or an understanding of how they might react to certain things is really key. But in those sort of initial moments of coach-head courses, when there's like, you know, introduce yourselves, or if there's a bit of an icebreaker, being present, you know, I think in a world of technology where your phones are always in your pocket, I think it's really important that we do stick to, you know, no one's on the phones, you are engaged, you are having conversations on the different tables with coaches, getting to know them, let them get to know you as well. Because the more you showcase sort of the person that you are as well in terms of your experience, because all they'll know is sort of a CV, sort of black and white version of like, this is who you are, this is where you've coached, this is the coach ed qual you've got, or you're an A license coach or whatever. That says nothing about who you are. That's just something on paper, and it's good for them to understand what you're like, because sometimes that can be intimidating for a coach if they see all this sort of stuff in terms of your experience. I think if you go in just as a human being and you know, and have a normal conversation, and it could, sometimes it's not even about having a conversation about football or coaching, sometimes just being, you know, just have a normal, like you would with anyone else, because I think that shows their personality. But then the key thing is, for me, the biggest differentiator, and I've seen this firsthand with my students as well, is that mentoring process, is dedicating the time within. So with all my students, prior to them delivering, they have a mentoring meeting with me, and I put in an hour of time per group or per individual, depending on who's delivering, where we literally go through every single aspect of their session that they have planned.
Right.
That's when I can check and challenge and see their understanding. That's where I get to understand where they're going with it. But also I can then rectify anything that needs sort of some attention, because what you can't do is then not have that conversation and then allow them to turn up and deliver something that isn't quite hitting the brief or isn't quite doing what it needs to do, that could have just been rectified in a conversation. Yeah. So I think dialogue is really, really important at all stages of the process.
I think that ultimately it's about giving them that fair opportunity to gain success or to achieve success in that moment. And I think, you know, like you said, you know, I've had it all, several times myself, like, you know, on a course as an example, whether that be, you know, on a degree that I'm lecturing, or whether it be on a, you know, regional course, where you might have one-to-one scheduled in, that someone, one person's one-to-one might be 45 minutes, another person might just be a 10-minute chat. So it is really making it bespoke for the individual in that respect. So I guess it's a really good point. And I think sometimes the challenge is, you talk mentor, and I say it a lot, I don't think I realized the importance of having a mentor until I finally started having them. But also, you know, the challenges I set coaches on a general level is, and I don't know what it was like for yourself coming through, but I remember back in the day when I started coaching and going through the coach education qualifications, key things were, at the end of it, they give you an action plan. And they always say something like, go away and observe some and work with some experienced coaches. Yeah, but if I don't know what good looks like, how do I know where I'm going to find that? And then, you know, as people would, in common sense, you know, prevails here, and if say, well, this person's got this qualification, they must know what they're doing, right? But obviously that's not always the case. So I guess, you know, in saying that, what would your guidance be for coaches listening to this thinking, right, I'm not even sure if I've had a mentor. I spoke to one of my mates yesterday, and he's been coached for about 20 years, and I asked him, have you ever had a mentor? And he goes, he actually had to think about it. He said, I don't think I've ever actually had one. And that's 20 years into that journey.
And that's crazy. And you just think, because all I think with that is like, oh, the missed opportunity there. Like, you know, to, he's obviously done great. He's been in the, you know, and he's still in the game. He's done it coaching for 20 years. But you think about, God, the opportunities during that 20 years where he could have been maybe stretched and got to a point quicker. And I think, you know, your point around observations and stuff, that's great. But again, you know, what are they looking for? Do they know what they're looking for? And I think, again, it's the whole context around, if you can go and observe a session and have a conversation with that coach around, you know, why have you done this? Or talk me through, you know, some of the best conversation or best things that I've observed have been, you know, when you've had that, they've given a little minute feel before it around, you know, this is what I'm trying to get out of the session. This is why I've structured it in this way.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This feeds into our philosophy this way. So it gives more context. You know, this is doing it this way because the players are better with this type of practice. Because you can't, it's not a one size fits all. Just because someone does, I don't know, rondos. Look, people love rondos and without even knowing what a rondo is for or what it does, you know, like, but they do it because they see it all on the telly and they see teams doing it. That's it's a perfect example of like, yeah, but what are you trying to get out of that? What's the purpose of it? But I think the mentoring process is key, and even just having an informal, a critical friend, as we'd call it, someone who, you know, can you have a look at a session? It's so important. Mentoring from a formal, it's bridging the formal, so you sort of your coach education courses, bridging it with the informal. And again, context is key, because how can you make that or bridge that if you don't know where this coach is coaching, what their experience is, who they are as a person, what their play is like? And that's where the knowledge of that individual is really key. And I think that's what's hard with coach education, formal coach education courses, is because it always comes to an end. At the end of the course, that's the end of the mentoring journey, unfortunately. Yeah. And I think that's something where I think if then there could be, I don't know, signposted to a mentor or mentors or opportunities, I think that would be something really meaningful. Yeah. But again, I think there's only certain coaches who would access that.
Well, this is the thing I was going to say, like, you know, coming back to your earlier point about, you know, once you come to the end of the formal coaching qualification, it's kind of an end of the journey, really. And I remember speaking to a coach recently on a B license. And he said to me, yeah, but we finished our course now. Like, what now? We've just got to continue learning, get out there and, you know, connect with different coaches. And I say to all the time, like, some of the best learning can come from you just having conversations with your peers. Go and watch each other coach, discuss why you're doing what you're doing. You might not have a formal mentor or someone in a quote unquote senior position, if you like, but it's just having coaching conversations that's going to help you to start. And, you know, the other kind of consideration I often have with coaches sometimes is, you can't, some coaches don't come into processes to learn and develop. They come into processes just to prove. And I find that those ones are probably the most challenging ones, because they probably don't realize how much there is to learn. And, you know, it goes for all of us, right? And I think I say to people all the time, like, me doing this podcast as an example has been the best CPD that I could ever imagine, because I'm just having conversations all the time with different people from different backgrounds, different experiences around the world, and even different disciplines, right? So it just gives me more to think about, and sometimes it will confirm what I think and believe, sometimes it will challenge that, sometimes it will be a thing where I say, do you know what, I really like the idea of that, I'm going to try that, but it's probably not right for the environment I'm currently in. That's fine as well. And then you don't necessarily have to always reinvent the wheel. Like, sometimes you are just doing good things. And I guess it goes back to my earlier point in that the question I ask is, well, how do we know this coaching stuff is really working? Because I guess if I throw another dilemma out there, and it will be, well, if you remove coaches from the game, you're still going to get top players, aren't you?
You definitely will. And I think it's around that purposeful learning, isn't it? And I suppose, to be devil's advocate, maybe the coaching isn't for those star players. Maybe the coaching is for everyone else around there that needs that additional support. But I think that there is a limitation with coach education, you know, that there's a requirement of it. So there is an infrastructure that where it is required within the game. And that's so important. I've worked in, and, you know, obviously I'm talking about football, but I've worked or had conversations around other sports where the requirements at any level, there is no requirement to have a coaching qualification, and which is food for thought. But also then there's such disparity within the levels or there's an assumption that there's such disparity within the levels of knowledge. But coach education is just that. It's like you know, your driving test, isn't it? It's there to show that you understand the whatever's pertaining to that particular qualification, that you can do it on the day, that you can showcase your knowledge. But that's the analogy that I use with my students when it comes to their actual assessment or their delivery. Is it's just like your driving test. You are there. Yeah. You don't drive every day like you do on your driving test.
Yeah.
When it comes to the test itself, you have to drive a certain way, and that's just like a coach ed qualification. But that's why for me mentoring, coach education is just coach ed, you know. Yeah. You get people who are badge collectors, you get people who are on it because their club has told them to. But really, if we can develop a robust mentoring process and mentoring framework, which makes them be reflective, because that's what all this is. You know, you doing this podcast, you've become reflective on everything, which is brilliant, because that's what makes us better in whatever profession it is. If we can try and encourage reflective practice, reflective thinking, criticality, so not just thinking everything's great because they're a pro license holder or everything I do is right, that's the difference. A coach ed qualification just shows that you can deliver a session with all the requirements of that qualification at that level. It showcases the level you can coach at, but it doesn't tell you anything about who you are as a coach.
100%. And I guess, you know, part of the challenge with coach education qualifications as well is that fine balance into how much is demonstrated through theory, how much is demonstrated through practice, right? And I say to coaches all the time, especially on courses when I'm delivering them, so like, use every interaction as an opportunity to demonstrate your knowledge and understanding. Try not to, you know, keep anything to yourself. Try and share what you can. Some of you are going to excel more in the theoretical aspects. Some of you are going to excel more in the practical aspects. But I guess the question that I would ask you is, someone could demonstrate an understanding of it, but lack the application of it. Now, in modern day coach education, you'd say, well, they've got an understanding of it.
And that's why I think, there's always going to be a blend of theory and practical in terms of requirements as well, you know, in terms of the coursework and the practical delivery. There's always going to need both. But for me, you know, we both probably face this with higher education, with students and the way we structure our assessments. You know, anyone can write a report, really. It might, some might be better than others, but a report on coaching, but how many of them can actually step onto the pitch and be a good coach? So if they're looking, if that's what they're wanting to do as a profession, well, ultimately you've got to be able to do it. So I think in a world where technology is also becoming more prevalent now, in the balance between online and traditional classroom methods, you know, it is difficult because even they can be so engaged online, but actually it's still, they can be as engaged as they want to be, but it's not never going to replicate the, for me, in my opinion, it's never going to replicate the traditional classroom, because there could be dialogue and conversations and questions that crop up authentically within a classroom that, you know, just don't online, because they think about it, but then they have to type it in the chat, or they have to bring themselves off mute, which can be quite daunting. So there are barriers, but there's also positives to that in terms of your reach of being able to get more people on courses. But I think it's going to be interesting to see where the future of coach ed goes, you know, with the integration of AI. I think there's going to be a lot of stuff around, well, we've always been thieves as coaches, aren't we? We steal each other's sessions, whether it's off YouTube, off Sports Session Planner, whatever it is. I just think now with AI and things like that, it's going to be interesting to see the creativity of coaches, because I think those questions are going to be answered by your AI. You know, here's my objective, these are my number of players, this is the stuff that, you know, design a session, which is great, but ultimately you've got to go and deliver that session though. So I think that's the
thing I'm getting at, right? Because, you know, I've had a few situations in the past where I'm thinking, well, this person's theoretically, their work looks outstanding, but they get on the grass and they can't deliver it. I would say they just facilitate the practice rather than actually coach a session. And one thing I always say to them, especially on courses in particular, when you come on a course, just forget the idea that these people are your under 10s. They're not. They're just a group of coaches just like you. Go on the course and just show us what you know. And that's my biggest message for them, especially from a practical standpoint. Now, I think the challenge is they come into that process wanting the session to be perfect. But I think the reality is experience tells us it's never going to be. There's always going to be something that you feel like you can develop on, or something that maybe could have been better or not quite right, or whatever it might have been. So the idea is not to deliver a perfect session, just to deliver what you think is right in that moment. And I think with that, you know, that then opens up the dialogue for, oh, okay, when I noticed you did this, but, you know, but you said you were going to do this in your plan, but it never quite came up. You know, can you tell me a little bit more about that? And it could be as simple as, do you know what? On reflection, as the session was rolling, I realized they probably weren't ready for that. Fine, fair enough. That in itself is good practice, right?
I think that's what's important is, but again, it's that reflection, you see, because how many times have we been on or been mentoring coaches or coach ed courses and they've delivered exactly what they've planned, but then you say, right, how do you feel the session went? And they're really positive about it, which is great, you know, but well, yeah, but there's no such thing as a perfect session. What would you change if you were to do it again? Would you do anything differently? And I think having that platform to ask those provoking questions, again, that's what's key, no matter their experiences, because sometimes you can have, and I'm sure you've been there as well, 10 times over where you've been mentoring a coach who all they see is the negatives and all, they just rip their own session apart. And so, again, you being there to then highlight the positives and the great things that went in the session. I think that's really important as well.
It's interesting because it's all about reflection. I try to frame a lot of my questions with coaches around the positive aspects. And yes, like, you know, I appreciate there's probably things to develop, but I often go into some reflection processes with coaches and say, look, if you had nothing negative to say about, if you weren't allowed to say anything negative, what would your comments on the session be? And, you know, they start to look at things. And it just makes them start to reflect and, like I said, dig deeper in their observations around, well, actually, everything's got a positive. What was it for you today? Even if it didn't go to plan, right? Okay, let's we'll talk about that later, but let's start with what you think went well. What, you know, what you did really well. And I think,
and also sometimes they, like, you know, the fact that they identify some, the fact that they've identified something that hasn't gone well, well, that's great. You've seen, you've seen the problem. You know, we use a really simple example is around, you know, like set the area size of a session.
Precisely.
And they come away from it and they'll say, oh, it was too small. Brilliant. You've seen the problem. So next time, just go, while you're in there, just change it. It's fine. But the fact that you've spotted it tells me you can see the problem.
100%, and that in itself is demonstration of understanding. I think the stretch zone, and that is, you know, the challenge for you next time is if that happens again, can you change it in the moment rather than after the moment? And I think that is for a lot of coaches a real challenge, right? Because it's almost being vulnerable to the idea that, oh, I didn't get this quite right, and if I change it now, the players might realize. But actually, there's some strength and power in that.
Vulnerability is massive, you know, and it's something that I'm a big advocate of around sort of your leadership aspect as well. I think the best leaders are ones that show vulnerability and are comfortable in that. Like you say, there's a strength in it. And I think it's almost, again, we've probably been in similar situations where there's been coaches who've coached in the game for a long time who do not like and not comfortable with being vulnerable in any sense of it. So trying to draw that out of them in a sort of structured way, while also sort of giving them the pat on the back of the things that they've done well is key. And again, that's where that individual differences, understanding individual coaches now to get the best down. Some of them are never going to want to be vulnerable. Some of them are never going to want to point out things that haven't gone very well. Same with players, just like with players, you know, you'll meet players that don't ever want to say, or don't want to take the blame for something. If something's gone wrong, they blame their teammate or whatever. It's the same sort of thing, but it's really interesting. Like I say, I think it's going to be an interesting next decade of coaching, particularly with the knowledge of the game now, you know, around sports science and multidisciplinary approaches of things, I think, because that's now more prevalent within all coaching now. But I think with other considerations around the social pillar and, you know, mental health and well-being, I think it's going to be interesting to see how player care and things like that, I think they will start to be integrated more so into coach ed as well.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point, and it, I guess it's great to see there's so much more, I guess, the information coming in, but sometimes it can be too much, right? Especially you know, when you're considering, like, at what level should this stuff start to be introduced? Because, you know, there are, even with coaching education, there has been some challenges around content for coach education qualification. Well, why is this being brought in at this level when it can be beneficial at this level? And, you know, there's almost that interpretation sometimes that some people aren't ready for that at a grassroots level when it starts getting pitched at more elite level qualification, like might be, you know, possibly weaved into the B license, possibly weaved into the A license, you know, even simple things like different approaches. But then it definitely will be interesting to see how coach education goes, coach development goes. But let's talk about that a little bit more, actually, because one of the things, and again, I don't know whether this is a play on words or whether I'm just being over-observant or critical, but one of the things that came to my mind recently was, I've been thinking about it for the last few months, why did we change it from coach education to coach development? Was it intentional? Was it someone saying, okay, we need to change, we need to just freshen things up? Because just the way my mind works, I try to look for meaning in everything.
And I think, but again, and it happens across the board, doesn't it? You've gone from sports scientist to head of performance, and, you know, there's all these different things happening. And I think from an education perspective, I think it's an interesting one, and I'd be more pro coach development, because I think same coach education, I think that's what the line between education and the coaching, I think, has become, I don't know if the balance for me, even though I'm a coach, I'm an academic, but I think sometimes that the balance isn't right. Sometimes I think it's gone far too scientific. It's gone far too that way, which then takes away from the ability to focus on the actual coaching and the practicalities of coaching. Yes, they need an understanding of the physical demands. Yes, they need to understand the psychological implications at times, or how to get the best out of players. 100% they do, but do they need to think about all the different physical components, as in what's a strength based session, what's an aerobic based session, what's a, do they really need to know the detail of that? And are they, do they then think about that far too much instead of thinking about the actual coaching environment that they're creating? Again, that's something that I go back and forth on a lot in terms of my own experience.
Yeah, so just on that, it's an interesting one because it's got me thinking that, you know, some would argue, and I'm not entirely sure where I sit on this, but some would argue that it's probably become easier to get qualified now than it once was. And within that, they would also probably potentially argue that the level of coaching from a technical standpoint might have dropped. But there's been more consideration around all the other stuff, like you said, the physical, social, all the other elements that come into it. But I think there's pros and cons to that. And I think there's some dangers as well. And I think the pros are definitely that you're going to develop a variety of types of coaches, different specialist coaches potentially, at different areas of the game, in different, you know, different kind of micro disciplines within it. But then I guess on the other side of it, people would argue, well, are the coaches actually teaching the game enough? Mm. Do they have enough knowledge to teach the game? I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
And look, and let me just say, I suppose it's important that having knowledge of all those different components is important, because, you know, how many coaches actually work in an environment where they've got a dedicated sports scientist or a dedicated whatever, you know, whatever it might be. So it's important to have those a baseline level of information. And I guess depending on the context, depending on the level, you may need more than others. But yeah, I think in terms of the actual coaching, I think it's so important that, well, you look at the professional game, I guess that's your answer. You know, does the manager or that, does the head coach of a team do all those things? No, there are dedicated members of staff who lead on those things. So I think that is your answer. You know, if you want to be a really good football coach and focus on the coaching, consider all these other aspects, but focus on the coaching, focus on the session you're putting on, objectives, the players, what are you wanting to get out of that practice? Because I think that's what it all comes down to.
Yeah, 100%. And I agree with that. But I think one of the observations I've made around certain coaches is that they maybe lack that football aspect and then they just hide behind something else. So, you know, when coaches say to me something like, I'm going to work in the physical corner today, I'm working in the social corner today. Are you really, like, why? Mm. Does that not happen when you just coach anyway?
And again, it comes back to that having a critical friend and a mentor to say, well, that's great, but what are you doing? So, you know, having their ability to hide is all dependent on the context or the environment that they're in that allows them to hide, I guess. Yeah. And I think it is, and I do agree with you. I think, you know, because then they've got more justification of doing certain things. Well, yeah, well, it's match day minus three and I'm looking to do this. Yeah, that's great. And I suppose it's if they've got someone there to challenge them on it, that's probably from an infrastructure perspective within football clubs. Or is there someone there that's going to check and challenge them? Although that this might be a physical day or it might be, you know, whatever it might be. Are you still making sure? Yes, from the players' perspective, because ultimately they're going to benefit from better coaching. But ultimately, are you doing the coaching injustice by allowing them to hide behind whatever the discipline that they're trying to hide behind, I guess?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it gets me thinking sometimes in terms of, you know, how do they, if they haven't got that critical friend, how can they become more reflective? And I think often for majority of coaches listening to this and majority of coaches generally probably working with youth players, and if their measurement isn't on how many games and how many goals are being scored, then it's often, I guess, a comment from a parent, oh, yeah, you're, you know, really good coach. And so I say, oh, well, do you ever ask them why? Mm-hmm. Don't just accept
it. And even down to players, ask the players, you know, like, because there's a really interesting piece of research done many years ago now around sort of that, an observation tool, bringing in sort of a standardized observation tool. I feel like it was from Loughborough, but around, they asked the players what they thought of the coach as a coach, and then they asked the coach what they thought they were like as a coach, and there were so many discrepancies in terms of who they thought they were versus the players. And sometimes I think for those who haven't got a critical friend or a mentor, being brave enough and vulnerable enough, to use that term again, to ask the players, doesn't need to be in a group setting, what do you think of me as a coach? Are there things that I could do better? What do I do well? But yeah, it's a very brave thing to open yourself up to that. But I think that's one way of definitely being reflective.
It just got me, it reminded me of a task that I used to do on the old FA level too. That's a bit of an icebreaker. And I'd set the scene and say, okay, well, Sarah, you're coaching in the park, you know, we've got no kits, everyone's just in bibs, there's two teams. If I was just walking past, what would be the things I see from your team that make me think straight away? That must be Sarah's players, right? And then I challenge them further, okay, brilliant. So that's the type of players that you want to develop. Now, what are the behaviors that you think that the coach should be exhibiting to get that out from the players? And then they come up with an idea of what the coach looks like. Okay, now how many of those behaviors are the ones that you're exhibiting yourself? And they're like, well, I'm not actually sure.
It's a really good way of breaking it down, you know, like that step by step. And again, because I think the term culture is used a lot now as well within football, like creating a positive culture, creating a high performance culture. That's the one used a lot. Culture ultimately will drive behaviors, like you just said, which will then drive certain other objective things on the pitch as well. Ultimately, the culture and environment, that, and I think that's a really interesting way of that you've just broke it down then, of how to sort of take themselves away from it and almost look at it from the opposite view, I guess. It's holding a mirror up to themselves, I guess, isn't it?
Well, I think so, because sometimes, you know, we've all been there. I'm sure some of us are still in the positions now where we think, oh, we want to behave in this way. We want to project this thought or this I guess way of working or whatnot, but it doesn't necessarily always align with what is required to do that. And sometimes it is the holding up the mirror. And again, because one of my early observations when I started getting into coach education, people don't really understand the power of the mentoring piece or having that critical friend. So my I guess one of my underlying principles when I'm delivering is always, how can I get them to become more reflective? If they haven't got access to a network, if they haven't got access to a critical friend for whatever reason, or they're not vulnerable enough to even just reach out to someone and say, do you know what, do you mind just giving me some feedback or let's have a conversation, then how do I get them to instill a little bit more in that in themselves? I started doing this myself, and I realized probably later on that actually was probably a very positive thing for me, is when I first started coaching, I started coaching with a group of under 14 boys, and at that age it's almost, they will check you and challenge you, well, why are we doing this? Yes, why are we doing that? Yes. Now, I never realized it in the moment, but on reflection I think to myself, I'm so glad that happened, because I actually then had to start thinking deeper about everything I was doing, because I was getting that check and challenge from the players. And then eventually, as time went on, I came up with this idea that coaches, really what you got to do is just take full accountability. So it's just basically, even when it's not your fault, it's your fault. Meaning, effectively, I'm always having to find a way to make this better. It could be something that's completely got nothing to do with me. But if I take the mindset of, no, it had something to do with me, what could I do differently? Then I'm always going to try and find a solution. And it comes back to the earlier point you made about some of the coaches. It's like, part of finding the solution is understanding what the problem is in the first place. So if a coach is able to identify the problem, okay, you might not have provided the solution right now, but you're halfway there because you actually know what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you don't know what the problem is, well, you ain't even going to begin to find the solution. And it's a great quote, and I think it goes, if you have no destination, any route will take you there. Mm-hmm. And it's literally that reflective process.
It's so, the difficult thing, or the hard thing is for those individuals who, you know, you say they can't diagnose the problem, and it could be down to that they're just their inexperience, or they can't work out the problem. And what makes me sad sometimes is that there's no outlet for them to then, you know, seek help to find the issue or the solution. So that's where I think maybe the FA, the FAW, you know, I think that's maybe where they need to sort of try and do more. You know, like I know, in here in Wales, we've got a thing called Coach Cymru, which is, you know, in partnership with the Coach's Voice, and there's lots of different resources and things like that. But I just think having that person, we do have coach developers and things like that regionally now, but I think in terms of the breadth, you know, the amount of coaches we've got, I think to be able to try and bridge that gap for them. I think that would be something really useful going forward, whether that's not in a traditional coach developer room or, you know, whether it is through a mentoring scheme, I'm not sure. But yeah. I think the journey for coaches would be much, I think they would feel much better, especially for more grassroots coaches who are facing, you know, I mentioned at the start, the hidden curriculum of football, who are having to manage parents, who are having to manage players with issues or certain things that they're trying to help with away from the game as well. I think there's definitely more to be done across the UK, really, with sort of supporting the demands that these coaches are facing now in the game.
Just linked to that then, what about the influence of CPD? Because I think one of the challenges with that is a lot of coaches don't engage in it proactively. Some do, some don't, many don't, and some only do to keep the qualifications validated. So obviously that kind of causes its own challenge, right? Because it's almost like, well, if my purpose is to keep my qualification validated, am I carefully selecting which CPDs I'm even attending?
And you're never going to get away from that in a certain element. You know, there's always going to be coaches who just do what they have to just to keep their qualification. You know, I'm victim, or not victim of that, but I'm a perpetrator of that, really, because my UEFA license runs out every 3 years. So every 3 years, I have to go to the National Coaching Conference. I only go on the year that I need to go to keep it valid. You know, I don't go any other time. So I'm that person as well. But again, I think it comes down to costings, you know, availability to go to these things as well. And that's why I think if we were looking at CPD, I think this is something that would need to sit outside CPD. I don't think this would be a CPD or traditional CPD thing. I think this would be something like, you know, you're looking for a mentor or a critical friend to discuss your sessions with. Here, you know, email this person.
Well, I guess my thoughts are coming from more specifically is that some coaches will not engage in CPD unless it is accredited with something that validates the qualifications. And my thing is, well, actually, no. Just go out and watch other coaches. Go out and attend things. Doesn't matter whether it's accredited or not, because there's loads of stuff out there. Even if it's just reading a book or, you know, looking at the latest research papers or whatever, like, that is CPD in itself. But you know, I guess the challenge more than anything is to coaches is what you're actually doing to develop yourself.
And I think, and it's hard, isn't it? Because this is what we go back and forth, even from an academic perspective, with any sort of short courses or any additional things. You're looking at where it can become accredited in some which way, because it is the way of the world now where, you know, you expect a certificate or you expect some kind of accreditation for any additional extracurricular thing that you engage in now. So it is difficult. And I guess my response to that is, I think for those who are seeking out, those individual coaches who are seeking out support will seek it out. I think those that don't want to engage in CPD unless it's, you'll get accredited or you unless it's towards something, you know, I think it would be a slow burner. I think if something was to be put and I think for me it's the power of partnerships as well. I think if it's something in partnership with the FAW, if it's something or the FA or whoever it might be, you know, you look at Powerhouse Project.
Yeah.
You know, I know a couple of people who are involved in the Powerhouse Project. That's something completely separate to the FA, but now they're affiliated with them. And that was coaches seeking out additional support to bridge the gap between their C license and their B. And you look at how much that's taken off. That's a fantastic example of exactly that, of that additional support and mentoring. So it's always a difficult one though, in terms of, I completely get what you're saying and I completely agree that, you know, not everyone's going to buy in unless they get something out or something tangible out of it that goes towards a qualification. They're not going to buy into it.
100%. So I'm really conscious of your time as well. Just a final question, really. What would your advice be to any coaches listening to this around how they can further develop themselves?
An interesting question. because there's so many things that you could say.
Yeah.
I would say seek out conversations before observations. So go and have conversations with coaches, practitioners of the game, not just traditional coaches. Go and just speak to people involved in football, people involved off the pitch as well. Get an understanding of the demands of all the different roles. But for me, get on the grass. Get on the grass and just coach. Just coach and have a go and then reflect after that session and then have another go. Because I think the more time you take away from being on the grass to do all these other things, you know, I think the biggest teacher is the game itself. So get yourself involved in as many sessions as you can, different age groups, girls football, boys football, men's, women's, whatever it is, because it'll all ultimately, you know, help them, help you grow as a coach. So yeah, just coach, just get involved as much as you can.
Amazing. Amazing. So I really appreciate your time. I don't know if you want to maybe share any details that you want to, if anyone had wanted to get in contact with you or anything like that.
Yeah. So if anyone wants any further information on anything that I've discussed today, they can contact me via email, sarah.hilton@wrexham.ac.uk, or, you know, find me on LinkedIn. I'm quite active on there as well. But yeah, I'm more than happy to have conversations around this sort of stuff or answer any questions or anything like that. No problem.
Amazing. Sorry, really, thank you for your time.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.